There are 23 million Americans in recovery. You are not alone. And there are so many people out there that get it. And even if you're just like questioning and asking questions, like and curious, it's worth talking to somebody about. It doesn't mean you have to just quit. It just means that you're being curious and trying to figure out your relationship to substances.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and we have a really great guest talking about a really important topic today. Her name is Sarah Benton. She is a licensed mental health counselor and alcohol and drug counselor, as well as the co-founder of BBHC, where she supports behavioral health companies in clinical startup and operational growth. She's also the author of Parenting in Recovery and Understanding the High Functioning Alcoholic. She's been featured in the New York Times, has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, CBS Early Show, Sirius XM, and NPR, to name a few. Sarah has also been in recovery herself since February of 2004. Now, I know not everybody listening to this is struggling with drugs or alcohol or has a child who's struggling with problems of those vein. However, you probably know somebody that is. So this is going to be a really important listen. Sarah Benton, welcome to the Daily Helping. I'm so grateful you're with us today.
Well, thank you for having me and for your interest in this topic and things related to it.
I think it's an interesting topic, right? Because parents in recovery, and we're going to do a deep dive, but most people just assume that their kids go through adolescence and everything's cool. And they, you know, you go to a party and there's a keg, or you go to college, there's a keg, right? But the reality is, there is an increasingly large demographic in this country who are young people who are turning to alcohol because their emotional distress has reached levels that are simply pathological and clinically diagnosable. So I'm grateful you've done the work that you've done. But before we get into that, I want to hear your story, Sarah, because I know we teased in the bio that you yourself have been in recovery for now over 20 years, and congratulations to that. But I think that's obviously an important foundational piece of your journey. So I'd love to hear your story, and then let's go from there, and then we'll get into the book a little bit.
So I am from New Bedford, Massachusetts, and I'm an only child. I grew up in what I would say is more of a dysfunctional neighborhood, but I came from an intact family unit. And I, as a therapist, often have tried to figure out the why around alcoholism. But from a young age, I grew up in an area where drinking was very popular. It was the 90s and nobody had GPS trackers on their kids. So anyway, I just recall my first experience drinking. I blacked out and didn't have a memory of majority of the evening. And that just seemed normal to me, even though I felt sick the next day, but I swore it off for a month, and I have it all in journal entries. So I know I can't recreate history because I actually have my writing from that age. I was 14 years old, and it didn't really change for me. I was very social. I was very outgoing. I did well in sports and also academics. And I had a lot of friends. And that was really kind of the paradox for me, was that I was drinking, I look back now, alcoholically from a young age, and still able to maintain the outside pieces. I also went away to college at, I think it was like the second ranked party school in the country at CU Boulder. So I picked really well for myself and had a blast. And I, you know, I really look back on those years fondly. And I think that's the other part of my story that is, has been odd for me, because when I hear, even as a therapist or when I'm in self-help meetings and I hear people's stories, they sound very miserable. Like I was actually having a really good time and I was more of a party drinker, social drinker. I didn't isolate and by myself. And so it was more of an excited celebratory activity for me. And, but I just didn't have a shut off. And so the drinking pattern that I had was I would have a few drinks, then I would sort of lose control over my intake. And it would usually end up with a blackout and some bizarre behavior and often unsafe behavior, and then wake up in the morning and apologize to everybody that I had upset. I thought that this was something I was going to outgrow. And so after college, and I moved to Los Angeles and promised my friends that I had moved with that, you know, things would simmer down. We had all partied together, but I kind of took things to the next level. I was actually working in television production out there and for the Disney Channel. And that was my first career, was literally production. And the technology's changed quite a bit since then. But I ended up leaving Los Angeles, and from the age of 23, when I left there, until the age of 27, I really was just kind of perplexed by my drinking. I thought when I turned 23 that I would suddenly turn into a normal drinker because I had grown up and I was a young adult, and all of a sudden I was going to drink like everybody else. And that was not what happened, and it was confusing. So I would take periods of time. I would stop drinking for 6 months, 3 months, and think that that would essentially reset the catch, and it didn't. So I moved to Nantucket Island, thought if I, you know, escaped onto an island and read Walden that my life would change. And I just found more people that drank like me when I was out there. Moved to Boston for 13 years, got my master's degree in counseling psychology. And at the age of 27, I basically woke up and just had this like moment where I just knew that I didn't want to feel the way I felt after a bad night of either embarrassing myself or my friends being upset at me and not knowing where I was, dreading looking at my cell phone. And I just didn't have it in me anymore. And at that same time, my friends came and talked to me that morning. So it was one of those where I actually was open to their and receptive to their help. But by that time, I had, through process of elimination, through trying moderation management, through trying every trick in the trade, had proven to myself that I was not able to control it. I needed that data, and that really helped me to accept it, even though I wasn't happy about it. So I basically, it was the Super Bowl. It was the Janet Jackson whole situation.
The wardrobe malfunction, if I recall.
Yes, the wardrobe malfunction. I apparently it happened, and I missed it on the big screen at the bar. So I guess that's a bottom. So yeah, basically, my life really changed at that point, and I went through a lot in early recovery, just in terms of my nervous system adjusting and post-acute withdrawal, and not withdrawal like detox, but just the nervous system effects, which people underestimate, that even for binge drinkers can happen for period of time. And I put together a plan for myself. I got therapy. I went to self-help. I did women's early recovery group. I did spiritual practices, yoga, and all of that. And I've stayed sober ever since. But that's when I wrote my first book, High Functioning Alcoholic, or Understanding the High Functioning Alcoholic, because I was confused by my ability to succeed and yet be alcoholic. And I didn't hear a lot of people talking or exploring that. After that book came out in my earlier sobriety, I continued on with public speaking and with being a therapist and all of that. And I started to specialize in addiction treatment. So that was a really, I was passionate, and it made a lot of meaning for, you know, what I had been through. And I felt like I was able to help people from a unique perspective. And then the topic for this particular book, you know, I became a parent about 7 years into my recovery. And I had like an aha moment at a bookstore with the Cindy House wrote a book called Mother Noise. And I was just perusing, and it said something about my 11-year-old child, and I, you know, whether or not to tell him about my story, and does he really know me if he doesn't know why I'm sober? And I was at that same point with my daughter, and I started to realize that there wasn't much out there as far as nonfiction books. There was memoirs, but there wasn't much out there about talking about parents in recovery, literally. And that book inspired me, and I was blessed to have her interview her for my book, but it helped my parenting experience make more sense in my mind. So it was another layer. I think there's a lot that people go through in recovery, from medical issues, from mental health issues, from addictive issues, from all kinds of recovery that people could identify with becoming a parent, and how it adds another layer of responsibility and of, I guess, in some ways, chaos and selflessness that is hard when you know that you need certain things to keep yourself balanced. So that's about where I'm at today. And I found that these two books really made sense of my own story. So it's hard to write about things that you don't feel deeply connected to.
I would say that's very true. And what's interesting, you know, that your book in particular, your first book, right, Understanding the High-Functioning Alcoholic, you were the epitome of the high-functioning alcoholic, getting master's degrees, you know, working for Disney, doing all these things, you know, even when you drink, it was fun, it was the party. You kind of mentioned, but I wasn't clear, so if I wasn't clear, forgive me, you said the line in the sand was the 2004 Super Bowl. What happened during that game? I don't think it was just that you missed the Janet Jackson halftime debacle. What was it about that made you say, you know what, enough is enough, I've got to make a change?
I think it was that I had started trying to control my drinking and moderate my drinking 4 years prior. And by that time, I was trying to, quote unquote, have three drinks when I went out, because that's the moderate, one drink an hour. I had all these rules for myself. And I watched myself break the rules right in front of myself. And it was kind of shocking, like an out-of-body experience to really, when, you know, I am a very disciplined and organized person. So to have a goal and not be able to reach it, and to feel powerless over something like a substance, is so baffling. And that night, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was like, I woke up the next morning, I wasn't home, I didn't know where I was. To me, that was a normal event, which is scary, but that was my normal. And I just didn't have it in my soul anymore to have people upset at me or lose control of my behaviors. And also, I knew at 27, I had this like radical acceptance that I wasn't going to be able to have the life I wanted if I kept drinking this way. Like, how am I going to have a spouse or partner and a child and be this kind of drinker? Like, I wasn't outgrowing it. I tried everything. It wasn't working. And everybody around me didn't want to call me an alcoholic. So that's where it got confusing.
Makes total sense. And, you know, in the very beginning when we were chatting, and I was talking about just the normalization of kids drinking, and it's part of the progression, and we go to school and we do all these things. And it's just, for you, that's what you thought too, right? It was just part of the, hey, you know, I'm a social drinker.
Right.
I go to these parties, and like when I graduate from college, it's like magically, like the clock strikes midnight.
That's what
right.
I thought.
That's what most people think. And that wasn't the case for you. But you know, as we've been chatting, and I'm realizing, my goodness, yeah, you know, I'm a parent, you're a parent, just being a parent is crazy.
Totally.
But then having this added layer of dealing with recovery. So what a gift to all of us that you've written this book, Sarah. I'm curious, because you'd mentioned your kid and you had a decision to make. So talk to us about the conversation you had with your daughter about your sobriety and recovery.
To quote Cindy House, of the telling was what she called it. My daughter always knew that my husband and I were did not drink, right? So that's obviously something that just came up because alcohol is part of our society. She thought that it was because we didn't think it was healthy. I work in the addiction treatment field, and so does my husband. And it's something we talk about all the time. This person's sober, that person's sober, this person relapsed. Like, the language she hears in the house is around, oh, this person's in recovery. So I actually thought that on some level she knew why we didn't. So when I sat down to tell her, one, I was writing a book about parents in recovery, and I felt like it was disingenuous to be writing this book and to not have my daughter actually know. Plus, she was getting to that age, a tween, where I felt like she was going to come into contact more with alcohol, whether it be at other friends' houses. Like, I didn't want her to be naive around it. So I sat down and explained it to her that the reason that I didn't drink is because I actually had an addiction to alcohol up until the age of 27, that it's ongoing, but that, you know, the meetings that I had been going to and things that I've been doing were in an effort to help maintain sobriety. And she was absolutely shocked. Like, I think it just, you know, you put your parents on a pedestal of some sort, and you also feel like they can't have a weakness. And not that I'm saying, well, yeah, addiction is a weakness. It's a vulnerability. And recovery is a strength. But I think that it really affected her appreciation for our recovery also, because she didn't know it was to avoid disaster, right? So she appreciates my husband and I being sober and has actually articulated her concern for if we were to ever relapse like that, she would move out. I know she's mean. I mean, she obviously, I mean, that's ambitious. But the point is, she takes it seriously. She really seems to somehow, as an old soul, recognize the seriousness of it. And also has some lack of interest in alcohol herself. Personally, I have tried not to impose that onto her. I don't want her to be afraid of it. Clearly, I was not afraid of it at her age. I was not afraid of it. But I think it's good to have a healthy fear, or a healthy respect is a better word, a healthy respect for substances. And that's really what I want her to have. Not a fear. I'm not trying to scare people straight. That's not my goal. But it was pretty powerful to have that conversation, just because I was so shocked at her shock. Because I figured with all the talk in the house, she's a smart kid, and that she would have sort of put all the pieces together.
I know this is a loaded question, because every kid is different, both in terms of maturity and developmental level and everything else. But at what age do you think is the right time for a parent in recovery to start broaching that conversation?
I did ask all of the parents that I interviewed for my book, I did ask them this question. And actually, in that chapter, you can see all the differing views. There are some people that bring their kids to self-help meetings early on because they have childcare issues, or they just want them part of a sober community. Like, there's just different reasons people do it. I have to say, there's some parents that avoid the topic as long as they can. I'm going to say, personally, I chose to share it at the age that I felt like she would be logically exposed to it more. And as a therapist, I want to speak to the topic. I do believe that our society talks a lot about medical issues, cancer, diabetes, and other autoimmune disorders and other medical issues from a genetic standpoint. Yet mental health and addiction seems to be something that parents shy away from sharing with their children. And that actually isn't really fair to them, because I think that they should have a shot at making some decisions and choices for themselves. So my daughter has alcoholism on both of, right, her father and her mother. And I want her to be aware of that, right? So from a decision-based standpoint, when inevitably she's faced with the choice to drink or not to drink, I want her to be armed with information, and also to know that if she waits until the age of 15 or after, that she'll decrease the chances of developing alcoholism by 40%, regardless of family history. That's very important information. So I think it's actually crucial to share it with your children at an age where they may be exposed, so that they are not naively entering in and knowing that they're more vulnerable to developing this condition, especially the earlier they start.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. You know, I've never really given thought, Sarah, to that fact, which you said was, you know, we are very quick to discuss medical issues, genetic issues. You would never not tell your child, hey, you know, I have a predisposition for this kind of cancer or this genetic, you know.
Get the right screening.
Absolutely. But yeah.
Watch your blood sugar. Let's test your blood sugar levels.
Precisely. But because of the stigma associated with addiction and mental health difficulties, people don't talk about it. So this is terrific stuff. And I'm so grateful we're having this conversation. So I know we kind of hit the book at an angle. We went into it. We've, you know, talked about a chapter. I'm sure we're doing this out of order, which is, you know, the way we do things. But talk to us, you know, if you're a parent in recovery, or you're a parent who's really struggling with their sobriety and they're not there yet, tell us some of the things that need to be top of mind.
I appreciate that the discussion around substance use and addiction has, in my opinion, increased post-pandemic. Access to care has increased due to virtual options. I think there was a sober curious movement that was born, I'm not quite sure when, but it just started allowing people to have the space to ask the questions and not have everybody say, oh my God, are you an alcoholic? Like, maybe I just want to figure out my relationship to alcohol or pot or whatever it may be, right? So that's an important piece of this, is examining your personal relationship to a substance. I don't, even with clients, I don't want to get caught up in labels. Like, it's really, it's, is it an issue for you? Is it something that buys up a lot of headspace in your mind? And I never understood why so many parents, or I heard it more from mothers, were drinking after they had children, and this kind of mommy sippy cups were for Chardonnay. And there was just this whole, like, I mean, I did a women's early recovery group in a wealthier suburb of Boston, and there were a lot of stay-at-home moms, and I was so baffled as to how many of them were struggling with drinking, and I didn't understand why until I had my own daughter. And so I started to get it. Like, I started to get the constancy and the never-ending kind of feeling of being a parent that you want to check out from. It is hard. And why I wrote this book is that I do believe recovery is a lifestyle change. And that's one of the pieces that I don't want to overwhelm people with. But I also think it's naive to think that you're going to just pull a substance out and live your life the same way. So in particular for parents, sometimes they're, you know, overachieving in their parent role and they are just doing everything, but they also are having their, you know, glasses of wine at the end of the day or whatever it may be. And then they decide, I'm going to kind of cut back on this. And I don't recommend cold turkey stopping if you're drinking daily. That can lead to withdrawal and seizures. But so they pull the substance out of their lives and suddenly they realize, oh my gosh, I've overscheduled myself. I've overstressed myself. I've said yes to far too many things. And the answer to that is that when you take out the glue that held things together, or, and sometimes made things worse, because a lot of people felt sick the next day and couldn't function as well, right? You have to adjust the way you live your life so that you don't need that checkout, right? So it involves pretty much a domino effect of removing the self-medication and then having to make these tweaks and changes to your self-care, to your job, to your what you say yes to the way you parent, to your downtime. It affects everything. And not everything at once. I mean, I help people in recovery. I don't want to say, okay, now just change 40 things, right? Like, that's just not realistic. But the point is that my life has been constructed around my recovery, and that takes time. And for parents that have children first and then get sober, it's hard because you're in the middle. Like, I got sober before I had my child, but it's hard. And I have friends and clients that have gotten sober after having children. It's totally possible. And the gratitude you see from the children can make everything worth it, because it's scary to have parents that are unpredictable, have unpredictable behaviors. They pick up on it more than you think. I've had many, many kids say things to me that shocked me about parents that drink quite a bit. I thought maybe the kids were used to it because that's what they grew up with. But you'd be amazed at how sensitive they are to that energy in their house. So I say it's worth everything to make the effort, but there's so much support you need and ways that you need to stop doing those people-pleasing, over-functioning patterns that maybe were going on, because it's not sustainable.
What I love about your book is you said recovery as a lifestyle, building that life around the recovery, but you've got a chapter called Get a Life. And this is amazing to me because basically so many people who go deep down that pit into drugs and alcohol, it's because they have that void of not knowing who they are. And you are slapping these readers in the face by saying, you need to have a sense of self. You need to have a professional identity. And then you follow that up with saying, look, like, I don't care how busy you are. You need to find time to take care of yourself. Because to me, those two things are so intrinsically connected that if you know, I don't care if you want to meditate all day long, but if you don't have a sense of who you are, your values, what's important to you, what defines you, what in your soul gets you excited to get up in the morning, you're more likely to fail than the person who really has a good handle on those things. So I think it's beautiful that you talk about that in your book. But there was one chapter that I find fascinating, and I'd love for you to go into. It's chapter 9. It's towards the end of the book, Buzzkill, which is fun in and of itself. Sober socializing in a digital age. So talk to us about that.
Well, first of all, thank you for picking up on Get a Life, because a sense of purpose is so important to everybody, whether you're in recovery or not. And a parent can lose themselves so easily. I don't care if you're mother or father. If you give up everything that was you to become a parent and don't focus on getting you back, you need a tether. And so I was determined to get social media and electronics into this book because it's changed the entire scope of how we interact with each other, particularly post-pandemic. So buzzkill, I love that term. And I jokingly say that, you know, being sober, when you walk up to people at a party, and I'm pretty honest about why I don't drink. And a lot of people may say, oh, I'm being healthy. Like, at this point, if you Google my name, it's pretty obvious why I don't. So I joke, I'm the buzzkill, like, oh, here's the sober person, you know, and everybody's enjoying their drinks. But this is probably one of the most complex issues that people have in their recovery, especially those that have created certain social circles. They spend time with particular parents, different sports events, different PTO, this, that, and the other, different groups that you migrate to. You typically, you know, what is it? Water seeks its own level. Like, you typically find people that have similarities to you. And when it comes to substance use, it's amazing how magnetic I could, no matter where I moved and where I lived in this country, I found people that drank like me. So I certainly would have too, as a parent. I certainly would have. But how do you undo that, right? Like, how do you connect with people when you pull the social lubricant out, when you change the dynamic, when you become unintentionally a mirror to other people? How does that work? And also, social media on so many levels. One, it creates fear of missing out. Everybody's doing their life highlights reel about how wonderful their lives are. And now you're scrolling through all by yourself. You have Celine Dion singing in the background of your head, like, you know, oh, I'm missing out on all of these things. And we're doing it to ourselves because we have a choice about what we feed our brain. And I do think there's amazing things that have happened because of social media and because of virtual this and that. Like, I really do. And I think it's actually changed the face of the mental health industry. But I also see clients and friends hurting themselves because they are making themselves feel like crap after they look at certain people's posts and things like that. So there's that component. Plus there's and I'm not know if you're familiar with the work of Ann Lemke, Dopamine Nation. There is this connection between the dopamine pathways that are established through our phones and addiction.
100%.
So those who are coming from a family with substance use addiction, it's also important for us to educate our children around dopamine, around The Social Dilemma is a brilliant movie. I think the first half of it is pretty appropriate for tweens and teens, as far as like the information the way it's distilled. But I've talked to my daughter about this because I feel like, okay, so that's great that you haven't drank, but like what's going on with the phone, right? Because there's a dopamine priming effect that Ann Lemke talks about, where there's people that would get sober and then now their phone, they have a new, it's whack-a-mole right now. This, is it food? Is it gambling? Is it sex? Is it, you know, is it my phone? But also, are we preparing our teenagers and those with their phones to have digital hygiene, to have balance around it, to understand how they feel before and after using it? And also, is it leaning or leading these pathways towards making it real easy to start smoking pot and drinking because it's that hit, that hit?
You're right on the money. I mean, the neurobiological effect of somebody liking your post is basically like taking a hit off a cigarette. It really is.
Yes.
And social media, and this is not tinfoil hat-ish, this is real. You know, whether it's TikTok, whether it's Instagram, whatever it is, these algorithms have evolved in a way that they're basically like they're slot machines in Vegas, right? And they know that you'll pull that lever again and again until you finally ding, ding, ding,
well,
ding, ding,
right?
Well,
that's what that movie talks about, is how these are people that broke away from their jobs at Facebook, Google, whatever, and they explain why, how they were designing things.
Yes.
It's fascinating. I mean, they were doing it intentionally. I mean, they're smart. Sometimes I appreciate a good algorithm. I don't want to see crap I don't want to see, right? But then there's also, you know, there's so many other elements to that. And also, what is it that the discerning nature of being younger and being predisposed to addictive behavior? So that's
yes.
The part where it ties in for me that I really wanted to get into in my book.
No, it's great that you did.
It's one of the hardest things that we deal with as a parent, is helping our kids navigate phone usage without making them social lepers, but also not turning them, you know, into vegetables. So it's like finding that fine line.
Even for adults, I often tell people, next time you have dinner, particularly if you're at a restaurant, put your phone in your pocket. And if you just have that itch, like you've got to grab that phone, what am I missing?
Yeah.
You probably have a problem.
Yeah.
And as you said, if somebody has this extra layer of addictive personality traits, genetic predispositions for addictive behaviors, that's something that's highly problematic. My goodness, Sarah. Our time together has flown by so quickly. What an important conversation. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. And that is, what is your biggest helping? That single most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
Definitely that they are not alone. I think that that is an experience that we often feel when we have a giant and what seems unsurmountable challenge in our lives, and also the one that may have stigma and shame associated with it. There are 23 million Americans in recovery. You are not alone. And there are so many people out there that get it. And even if you're just like questioning and asking questions, like, and curious, it's worth talking to somebody about. It doesn't mean you have to just quit. It just means that you're being curious and trying to figure out your relationship to substances.
Well said. Well said. The book, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle, is available everywhere. But Sarah, if people are excited about our conversation and they want to learn more about you, where can people find out about you on the internet?
So my website is bentonbhc.com. And my email is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at bentonbhc.com. I have several socials that I can get over. And I have Parents in Recovery is my Instagram handle. I'm not on that one as much. I have to say most things are going onto my Facebook and LinkedIn. But I will get all of those links over. I also have a Psychology Today blog that I feel very blessed to have, and it's called The High Functioning Alcoholic, and I also have been doing a Parents in Recovery series on that.
Fantastic. And for those of you at the gym, no worries. Everything Sarah Benton will be linked in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a powerful and important conversation. I'm so grateful we had it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day to listen to this, thank you as well. If you're inspired, if you learned something, if this has given you a lot to think about, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find the show But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your social media feeds using the hashtag #MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.